Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How propaganda works, particularly in democratic settings. With us is Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley. It's great to have you here. Your new book, How Propaganda Works, you do a real philosophical look at this and a bit of a historic look, especially through modern history, and I think that's really important. Before we started recording, we were talking about how even appointments can serve as a means of propaganda. What have you observed?
Well, I think if you look at some of the appointments that our president-elect has made to various departments, and you can see that he has a strong tendency, as Saturday Night Live has noted, to appoint people who to serve the mission of those departments who don't believe in that mission. For instance, Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who said that he was going to eliminate the Department of Energy, is the nominee for the Department of Energy. And Scott Pruitt, who is a environmental, he now conceives that there's man-made human-caused climate change, but he's generally a climate change skeptic, looks like he's going to be the head of the EPA, and then all down the road. This doesn't hold true for every appointment, but for example, Betsy DeVos, who is going to be Secretary of Education, it looks like, and she's been a strong figure arguing essentially against public education. So what the president-elect is doing is he's appointing the main enemies of various tasks as the people who will run those tasks for the federal government.
And so how does this fit in with propaganda itself?
Well, I characterize a notion of propaganda I call undermining propaganda in my book, which is the kind of propaganda one finds characteristically in liberal democratic societies, officially liberal democratic societies like our own in the United States. And undermining propaganda works by taking a cherished ideal, to say education or the environment, and then using it as a way to undermine the realization of that very ideal. So if you have someone who doesn't believe in human-caused climate change tasked to run our nation's policies for the environment, then what you're going to find is that person saying this is good for the environment, but in fact, their actions will undermine what is good for the environment. So under the guise of the department or cabinet position itself, which gives one cover, after all, the Secretary of Education is supposed to stand up for public education, is supposed to stand up for the ideals of public education, that can give, for example, DeVos cover to undermine those very goals.
It sounds like a classic 1984 sort of war is peace approach.
Right. For example, the Guantanamo Bay prison is called Camp Justice.
Right.
So this didn't start now. Operation Iraqi Freedom is a salient other example.
And I think we saw that in the Bush administration quite a bit with the so-called Clean Skies Act and No Child Left Behind and those types of phrases that were not really attempting to bring across those missions.
They were really doing the reverse, weren't they?
You looked at the actual regulations of, say, the Clean Skies Act, they were being dismantled. So you would think, yes.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So that's another paradigm example.
Right.
You name things the opposite of what they actually do. And that's undermining propaganda in my sense. And I really think we need a narrower characterization of propaganda than the one that ordinarily comes to mind, which is cherry picking, producing an argument from one perspective, because that's too general. Then every argument, especially in politics, is propaganda. And that's too general of a characterization for such a nefarious and dangerous political strategy.
Let's look at your definition of propaganda. How are you defining it in this new book?
So I go through different definitions of propaganda in the second chapter, and I argue that the classical definitions in terms of bias and cherry picking are too general because virtually everything counts as propaganda. I mean, each word shades things in a certain way. So if I call someone a professor, that will raise certain connotations in the hearer's mind and hence bias the discourse. So almost every word has that kind of feature where it brings with it connotations that slightly slant the discourse. They don't make the discourse non-factual or inventing reality. They just sort of bias it slightly. If somebody says, "Professor, this professor said," then if they're talking to one kind of audience, that might give that source a very negative casting. And another audience, it might give that source a positive casting. But that's extraneous to the information being delivered. So I think that propaganda as speech that biases a conversation is too general. So I focus on a narrower characterization. I have two categories of propaganda. One I call supporting propaganda. And supporting propaganda is the kind of propaganda we find most characteristically in authoritarian societies. And unsurprisingly, you find authoritarians such as Goebbels or Hitler, when they describe propaganda, focusing on supporting propaganda. Supporting propaganda is propaganda that shuts off rational thought. It overwhelms rational thought with, as Klemperer calls them, emotions detached from their ideas. The idea here is not to draw a distinction between rationality and emotion. Emotions can be perfectly rational. It's perfectly rational to be fearful at certain times in history. It's perfectly rational to be fearful when you see a snake or something like that. Those are rational emotions. But supporting propaganda takes sort of accentuates emotions and causes the audience to cease reflecting upon the arguments provided. And as Klemperer says, and Goebbels, of authoritarian National Socialist propaganda, the goal is to fuse the audience into one emotion. And so that's supporting propaganda. Now, I focus less on the mechanisms of supporting propaganda in my book, because when I did write my book, I was assuming that many societies, including my own, had at least an attachment to liberal democratic ideals. So I focused mainly on what I call undermining propaganda. And undermining propaganda is an argument that employs an ideal in the service of a goal that undermines that ideal.
So aside from these examples we started to talk about at the very beginning of our discussion, link in the ideology here too, because you talk about ideology quite a bit in your book and the role of ideology and the types of ideology.
So I'll give you some examples of how, on my account, undermining propaganda and ideology work together. So undermining propaganda only works if there's some ideology there that the hearers have, the desired target audience has, that enables them to not see the tension between the ideal and the goal. So, for example, suppose you thought that immigrants weren't really fit to be fellow citizens. Then you might think that measures used to harshly treat them were in line with justice, were in line with humanism and justice, because you regard immigrants as a class that isn't, you have an ideology, an anti-immigrant ideology, that leads you to think that the native-born are the real humans and immigrants are somehow deficient. And so that ideology would allow a politician to be harshly xenophobic, but using the language of humanity and justice, because the target audience would have an ideology that prevented them from seeing that there was a tension between xenophobia and humanism.
Now, you used a phrase in the book, flawed ideology. What specifically makes it flawed?
Here I follow my colleague, the cognitive scientist Dan Kahan, who characterizes ideologies in terms of social identities. My social identity is I'm Jewish. I'm sort of a New York East Coast intellectual. I dress a certain way. I have two small children. I strongly identify as a parent and a family member. These are very powerful features of my social identity. Things that speak to the difficulties of parenting are things that speak to me. I strongly identify, for example, as a father, as a parent. And so I'm going to be political messages that are wrapped in what are familiar to what are in vocabulary that speaks to my social identity. the difficulty of parenting, you know, the challenges facing families in the modern world, those things are going to speak to me. Those things, that identity is, I'm going to have more strongly. The beliefs, there are certain beliefs that people connect with, say, parenting, with being a parent and strongly identifying as a parent. There are certain beliefs that, to take just an easier example, are certain beliefs that strongly connects with being a East Coast American intellectual or being Jewish. And it's going to be very hard for me to give up those beliefs. It's very hard for me to give up my devotion to my children over, even though I somehow intellectually recognize that all humans, not just my children, have an equal claim on my moral sensibilities. So, no, it's going to be hard for me to give up the theory of Darwin's theory of evolution, even if compelling scientific evidence were given, because it's so connected. Even though there's strong rational support for it, there's also a strong emotional connection for me. Similarly, I have a strong identity being a child of two refugees from authoritarianism. I have a strong patriotic identity as an American. And so it's hard for me to see that America doesn't stand for the values I cherish, liberty and equality. And I'm in denial when the United States does very bad things, for example. So a flawed ideology. So we all have ideologies because we all have social identity. So everyone has an ideology. Everyone has beliefs they're more reluctant to give up than other beliefs, not for non-rational reasons. I mean, if you're connected to a group or say a religion or a country, well, giving up some of the beliefs about those that country's virtues is going to separate you from your friends and your social and your community. I mean, if you're raised in my cousins in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family, you know, you will lose your entire community if you give up some of your beliefs. And that's not a rational argument for those beliefs, but it's just an emotional appeal. So we all have ideologies. We all have certain beliefs that we're very reluctant to give up for non-rational reasons, because they connect, because giving them up would mean losing all your friends. Now, a flawed ideology is an ideology that causes you, a flawed ideology is in the first instance relative to a topic, say politics or political decisions. A flawed ideology about, say, immigration is one that where you have certain beliefs that are connected to your social identity that prevent you from recognizing the evidence that's available in reality because of that ideology. And it's flawed because it prevents you from accessing evidence.
So how does that connect then with flawed social structure?
Flawed social structures. So right, I characterize this ideology in terms of belief, but we need to think of ideology as fundamentally material and beliefs as only secondary. Flawed social structures are set up to make you have a flawed ideology, have flawed beliefs, to prevent you from getting the access to the evidence you need about social reality. For example, I lived in Harlem for many years, which is traditionally America's, the capital of African-American culture and Black America. And although I'm in an interracial family, we were quite wealthy, well off. My wife is a doctor. And so we lived in a nice apartment, and it wasn't as, and Harlem is also gentrifying. And it turned out that the path I took from the subway to my very nice apartment building prevented me from seeing what was happening on a lot of streets of Harlem. For example, one day I spit on the ground and a young man approached me and he said, "Aren't you afraid of being arrested?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "You can't spit, you get a fine." I said, "I don't get a fine," you know, because I'm not, I didn't actually walk on heavily policed streets. I was walking on sort of a gentrification path.
And you're white.
And I'm white, both those features, exactly. My partner, who's African-American, was stopped once and given for changing lanes and given an extremely harsh ticket, like up to 6 months in prison for reckless driving, cutting someone off. And she went to court, and all she had to pay was a $500 fine or a $250 fine to get it cleaned off. So if you have access to money and you're, you can sort of escape America's structural injustice. But what she noted is that even in Manhattan, that bastion of liberalism, everyone else in traffic court was African-American or Hispanic.
How does propaganda in a liberal democratic state differ from, say, propaganda in a more authoritarian, totalitarian state?
Excellent and very prescient question right now. As I say in my book, the difficulty, there's sort of reverse difficulties. In an authoritarian state, the problem with propaganda is that people don't believe it. People don't believe when the leaders say things, people don't believe that they're going to go through on what they say because they say it's just propaganda. And you find this repeatedly throughout the literature on authoritarianism. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, has a whole chapter on this where he talks about how no one would believe that Hitler was really anti-Semitic. And my grandmother wrote one of the first Holocaust memoirs in the English language called The Unforgotten, which is a very important book to read right now, sadly out of print. And she talks again and again about this. She didn't leave Germany until August 1939. And she talks about a kind of refusal to believe that National Socialists were serious. And there was a period in time in Nazi Germany when there were parties where my grandmother speaks of this, where she's at parties with Gestapo officers and SS officers who are like, well, we don't mean you. Come on. So in authoritarian societies, people just dismiss what's said. In liberal democratic societies, people don't believe there's propaganda. So they don't believe leaders can be lying or misleading. And so what I think you're seeing now is a blurring together, you sort of, as people employ authoritarian tactics in liberal democratic society, you're finding people saying, oh, come on, that's just propaganda. Whereas earlier, they would have either said, oh, they're wrong, or they must know something. The propaganda of liberal democratic societies is that there's no propaganda. And what happens in authoritarian societies is that people too willingly dismiss it as mere propaganda. And most importantly, in authoritarian propaganda, you invent reality. And I don't really discuss this in my book, and I've tried to make up for it in my subsequent newspaper articles. But in an authoritarian society, the authoritarian leader demonstrates their power by creating reality. In an authoritarian society, the main principle is power. In a liberal democratic society, the main principles are equal respect and truth, which work together. So in an authoritarian society, what happens is that the leader wants to strengthen certain ideologies. So the leader demonstrates the leader's power by simply strengthening, making up reality to strengthen the flawed ideologies people already have. So they might say, there's a wave of violent crime. Or they might say, immigration poses a fundamental threat to our freedoms. Or they might give example, they might invent the reality that will lead people to strengthen the ideology that they're already susceptible to. So if in the United States election, we saw repeated claims that American cities were in flames and there was the highest crime rates ever, even though we're close to historic lows in crime. And that was an invention of reality to strengthen an ideology. And in authoritarian societies, people like power. People admire powerful leaders. So a leader demonstrates their power by inventing reality. In a liberal democratic society, there are strong norms to punish anyone who clearly violates, who says false things. And you know that liberal democratic values are crumbling when you see politicians being rewarded for inventing reality rather than being punished.
This is partly why you argue that propaganda threatens liberal democracies.
Yes, propaganda is a terrible threat to liberal democracies, but it can also be what's required to help liberal democracies. Propaganda can be used as a weapon to restore democratic ideals. For example, it can be directed against bad ideals. And this is what I discuss in my book under the label of civic rhetoric. Civic rhetoric, I'm very much devoted to the ideals of liberty and equality, and I might try to restore those goals, as Du Bois argues in his 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art. I might restore those ideals by focusing on flawed ideals and showing how they're in tension with freedom and equality. So Du Bois calls for artists to appeal to white audiences with negative images, with the sort of images, dehumanizing images of Black American citizens as mere dancers, people who dance and joke. But then within that paradigm, draw them into the theater that way, but then explode those negative ideals, undermine those negative ideals by showing the humanity of some of our fellow citizens who have been unfairly caricatured. And you can see this happening in the early 1990s with rap and hip hop. That was supposed to, there was a crisis of mass incarceration. There was a crisis of over-policing, a lack of empathy. And you had American citizens, descendants of enslaved Americans, producing music that was attempting to show that people in the situation were human and they were in fact being subjugated by these harsh, punitive ideologies. But they drew listeners in by, quote unquote, glorifying violence.
One of the things about this particular issue that you wrote about in the preface of the book, when you were talking about mass incarceration, what struck me was your discussion about how this robs potential, the ideology of this, the propaganda of this, the false beliefs about this. Can you elaborate on that a bit, on the human potential aspect of this?
For the case of mass incarceration?
Sure. And if you want to connect that to the wider structures of society.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply influenced. I stand on the shoulders of feminist theorists and Black American theorists whose work I employ, and particularly scholars of American mass incarceration. So I'm teaching, for example, Elizabeth Hinton's book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, to the War on Drugs, which is an account of the Nixon administration's propaganda that created a system that incarcerates somewhere between 2.2 million and 2.5 million people in its prisons, both federal, state, and local. Our incarceration rate is 752 per 100,000, which dwarfs any other nations in the world. Russia is second at 500 some out of 100,000. And the next liberal democracy is the UK at 150 or 149 per 100,000. So our incarceration rate is staggeringly high. And we have eight times the rate that we did in 1973. In 1973, we had 300,000 people in prison, jail, or federal prison. Now we have between 2 and 2.5 million and 8 million people on probation or parole. So what happened was, in the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement involved a lot of protest. And some of that protest turned violent, like in Detroit, famously. And what Nixon did when he took office is he changed the narrative from social justice and equal rights to law and order. And he repainted and redescribed the protests as riots. So, and we find the same thing happening today, by the way. If you look at Fox News and their descriptions of what happened in Baltimore, a city that was racked by protests over police malfeasance, police misconduct, you see Fox News described the protests as riots, used the word riot seven words out of 1,000 in its reports about Baltimore. And they used protest less than three words out of 1,000. CNN was more even-handed. They used the word riot just under four words per 100 per 1,000, and the word protest just over three words and per 1,000 in describing Baltimore. And MSNBC used protest slightly more than riot in describing what was happening in Baltimore. This is why I said that you can't define propaganda as, you know, skewed discourse, because each word carries this way of skewing reality. I mean, there were people and they were gathering and they were doing things, but how you describe it is going to really affect the uptake. So Nixon redescribed what was happening, not as protests, but as riots, and then shifted the nation's attention from the ideals of equality and social justice to law and order. And then he applied law and order in a way that undermined law and order, because he applied it unequally, where it fell particularly harshly on Black Americans and political dissidents.
Let's look at your definition of propaganda. How are you defining it in this new book?
So I go through different definitions of propaganda in the second chapter, and I argue that the classical definitions in terms of bias and cherry picking are too general, because virtually everything counts as propaganda. I mean, each word shades things in a certain way. So if I call someone a professor, that will raise certain connotations in the hearer's mind and hence bias the discourse. So almost every word has that kind of feature where it brings with it connotations that slightly slant the discourse. They don't make the discourse non-factual or inventing reality. They just sort of bias it slightly. If somebody says professor, this professor said, then if they're talking to one kind of audience, that might give that source a very negative casting. And another audience, it might give that source a positive casting. But that's extraneous to the information being delivered. So I think that propaganda as speech that biases a conversation is too general. So I focus on a narrower characterization. I have two categories of propaganda. One I call supporting propaganda. And supporting propaganda is the kind of propaganda we find most characteristically in authoritarian societies. And unsurprisingly, you find authoritarians such as Goebbels or Hitler, when they describe propaganda, focusing on supporting propaganda. Supporting propaganda is propaganda that shuts off rational thought. It overwhelms rational thought with, as Klemperer calls them, emotions detached from their ideas. The idea here is not to draw a distinction between rationality and emotion. Emotions can be perfectly rational. It's perfectly rational to be fearful at certain times in history. It's perfectly rational to be fearful when you see a snake or something like that. Those are rational emotions. But supporting propaganda takes sort of, it accentuates emotions and causes the audience to cease reflecting upon the arguments provided. And as Klemperer says, and Goebbels, of authoritarian National Socialist propaganda, the goal is to fuse the audience into one emotion. And so that's supporting propaganda. Now, I focus less on the mechanisms of supporting propaganda in my book, because when I did write my book, I was assuming that many societies, including my own, had at least an attachment to liberal democratic ideals. So I focused mainly on what I call undermining propaganda. And undermining propaganda is an argument that employs an ideal in the service of a goal that undermines that ideal. So undermining propaganda only works if there's some ideology there that the hearers have, the desired target audience has, that enables them to not see the tension between the ideal and the goal. So for example, suppose you thought that immigrants weren't really fit to be fellow citizens. Then you might think that measures used to harshly treat them were in line with humanism and justice, because you have an ideology, an anti-immigrant ideology, that leads you to think that the native-born are the real humans and immigrants are somehow deficient. And so that ideology would allow a politician to be harshly xenophobic, but using the language of humanity and justice, because the target audience would have an ideology that prevented them from seeing that there was a tension between xenophobia and humanism.
Now, how does propaganda in a liberal democratic state differ from, say, propaganda in a more authoritarian, totalitarian state?
Excellent and very prescient question right now. As I say in my book, the difficulty, there's sort of reverse difficulties. in an authoritarian state, the problem with propaganda is that people don't believe it. People don't believe when the leaders say things, people don't believe that they're going to go through on what they say because they say it's just propaganda. And you find this repeatedly throughout the literature on authoritarianism. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, has a whole chapter on this where he talks about how no one would believe that Hitler was really anti-Semitic. And my grandmother wrote one of the first Holocaust memoirs in the English language called The Unforgotten, which is a very important book to read right now, sadly out of print. And she talks again and again about this. She didn't leave Germany until August 1939. And she talks about a kind of refusal to believe that National Socialists were serious. And there was a period in time in Nazi Germany when there were parties where my grandmother speaks of this, where she's at parties with Gestapo officers and SS officers who are like, well, we don't mean you. Come on. So in authoritarian societies, people just dismiss what's said. In liberal democratic societies, people don't believe there's propaganda. So they don't believe leaders can be lying or misleading. And so what I think you're seeing now is a blurring together, you sort of, as people employ authoritarian tactics in liberal democratic society, you're finding people saying, oh, come on, that's just propaganda. Whereas earlier they would have either said, oh, they're wrong, or they must know something. The propaganda of liberal democratic societies is that there's no propaganda. And what happens in authoritarian societies is that people too willingly dismiss it as mere propaganda. And most importantly, in authoritarian propaganda, you invent reality. And I don't really discuss this in my book, and I've tried to make up for it in my subsequent newspaper articles. But in an authoritarian society, the authoritarian leader demonstrates their power by creating reality. In an authoritarian society, the main principle is power. In a liberal democratic society, the main principles are equal respect and truth, which work together. So in an authoritarian society, what happens is that the leader wants to strengthen certain ideologies. So the leader demonstrates the leader's power by simply making up reality to strengthen the flawed ideologies people already have. So they might say, there's a wave of violent crime. Or they might say, immigration poses a fundamental threat to our freedoms. Or they might give example, they might invent the reality that will lead people to strengthen the ideology that they're already susceptible to. So in the United States election, we saw repeated claims that American cities were in flames and there was the highest crime rates ever, even though we're close to historic lows in crime. And that was an invention of reality to strengthen an ideology. And in authoritarian societies, people like power. People admire powerful leaders. So a leader demonstrates their power by inventing reality. In a liberal democratic society, there are strong norms to punish anyone who clearly violates, who says false things. And you know that liberal democratic values are crumbling when you see politicians being rewarded for inventing reality rather than being punished.
This is partly why you argue that propaganda threatens liberal democracies.
Yes, propaganda is a terrible threat to liberal democracies, but it can also be what's required to help liberal democracies. Propaganda can be used as a weapon to restore democratic ideals. For example, it can be directed against bad ideals. And this is what I discuss in my book under the label of civic rhetoric. Civic rhetoric, I'm very much devoted to the ideals of liberty and equality, and I might try to restore those goals, as Du Bois argues in his 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art, I might restore those ideals by focusing on flawed ideals and showing how they're in tension with freedom and equality. So Du Bois calls for artists to appeal to white audiences with negative images, with the sort of images, dehumanizing images of Black American citizens as mere dancers, people who dance and joke. But then within that paradigm, draw them into the theater that way, but then explode those negative ideals, undermine those negative ideals by showing the humanity of some of our fellow citizens who have been unfairly caricatured. And you can see this happening in the early 1990s with rap and hip hop. That was supposed to, there was a crisis of mass incarceration. There was a crisis of over-policing, a lack of empathy. And you had American citizens, descendants of enslaved Americans, producing music that was attempting to show that people in the situation were human and they were in fact being subjugated by these harsh, punitive ideologies. But they drew listeners in by, quote-unquote, glorifying violence.
One of the things about this particular issue that you wrote about in the preface of the book, when you were talking about mass incarceration, what struck me was your discussion about how this robs potential, the ideology of this, the propaganda of this, the false beliefs about this. Can you elaborate on that a bit, on the human potential aspect of this?
For the case of mass incarceration?
Sure. And if you want to connect that to the wider structures of society.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply influenced. I stand on the shoulders of feminist theorists and Black American theorists whose work I employ, and particularly scholars of American mass incarceration. So I'm teaching, for example, Elizabeth Hinton's book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, to the War on Drugs, which is an account of the Nixon administration's propaganda that created a system that incarcerates somewhere between 2.2 million and 2.5 million people in its prisons, both federal, state, and local. Our incarceration rate is 752 per 100,000, which dwarfs any other nations in the world. Russia is second at 500-some out of 100,000. And the next liberal democracy is the UK at 150 or 149 per 100,000. So our incarceration rate is staggeringly high. And we have eight times the rate that we did in 1973. In 1973, we had 300,000 people in prison, jail, or federal prison. Now we have between 2 and 2.5 million and 8 million people on probation or parole, which is brutal in the United States. It prevents you from getting jobs, etc. So what happened? So what happened was in the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement involved a lot of protests. And some of that protest turned violent, like in Detroit, famously. And what Nixon did when he took office is he changed the narrative from social justice and equal rights to law and order. And he repainted and redescribed the protests as riots. So, and we find the same thing happening today, by the way. If you look at Fox News and their descriptions of what happened in Baltimore, a city that was racked by protests over police malfeasance, police misconduct, you see Fox News describes the protests as riots, used the word riot 7 words out of 1,000. In its reports about Baltimore. And they used protest less than 3 words out of 1,000. CNN was more even-handed. They used the word riot just under 4 words per 100 per 1,000 and the word protest just over 3 words per 1,000 in describing Baltimore. And MSNBC used protest slightly more than riot in describing what was happening in Baltimore. This is why I said that you can't define propaganda as, you know, skewed discourse, because each word carries this way of skewing reality. I mean, there were people and they were gathering and they were doing things, but how you describe it is going to really affect the uptake. So Nixon redescribed what was happening, not as protests, but as riots, and then shifted the nation's attention from the ideals of equality and social justice to law and order. And then he applied law and order in a way that undermined law and order, because he applied it unequally, where it fell particularly harshly on Black Americans and political dissidents. This year, his statement, Elizabeth Hinton, I think, discovered this. I'm not sure who discovered this, but it was revealed in the past year that Nixon said, we're going to have a war on drugs and we'll target marijuana to get the hippies and we'll target heroin to get the Blacks. So it was explicitly, and then we'll humiliate them on national television over and over again. So Abby Hoffman was caught up in this. And what happened is you shifted the nation's attention from one set of ideals to another. And you could do this with, you could shift. And we've seen this happen with the Syrian refugee crisis. At first, social justice saved these refugees, and then it was shifted to, danger, terrorism, law and order, protect us. So then what happens when you shift, shift the ideals, then you can filter them through a flawed ideology. So that you can see that the war on drugs was a flawed filtered through a flawed racist ideology. You can see this from the differential reaction to the opiate and heroin crisis devastating white communities today, which is dealt with by empathy, versus the early 70s reaction to Black heroin usage, which was where it was only punitive and there was no empathy at all. So Americans had in the early 70s and today, have a flawed racist ideology. So when you have law and order there centered, and they think of, say, drug use by Black fellow citizens, their reaction is punitive. But when they think of drug use by white fellow citizens, their reaction is empathetic. So mass incarceration is law and order differentially applied through flawed ideology, racial ideologies. But that undermines law and order, democratic law and order, because at the very core of democratic law and order is fairness and impartiality. And so we should have the same reaction to a 16-year-old white heroin user and a 16-year-old Black heroin user. And we see quite clearly from American history that our government does not have the same reaction. We can see that Nixon, when he was calling for law and order in the face of these protests, and when he was calling for law and order in the face of a drug crisis, was relying on the flawed racist ideology. And that's why he said, we're going to have a war on drugs to target the Blacks.
Would you say that inequality feeds propaganda, or that propaganda is creating inequality, or is this a mutual system?
It's a mutual system. The flawed ideology arises from inequality, because those who benefit from inequality have a legitimation myth. They have to tell themselves that they deserve their place. They deserve it. And so when it's so clear that they don't deserve it, say birth position, you do nothing to deserve your own birth position. So those who are born into a privileged birth position, whether by gender, by sexual orientation, by race, by citizenship status, tend to think that they deserve it. And so when there's inequality, that gives rise to this flawed ideology that protects you from having to face your own complicity in structural injustice. And then that allows propaganda to flourish, because a flawed ideology is what prevents you from recognizing the inconsistency between the ideal and the goal. What could explain the radically differential reaction Americans have to white heroin use versus Black heroin use, other than a very different conception of those whom they should regard as equals? So when you have a flawed ideology, a legitimation, when you have inequality, unless you want to face your own complicity, which requires action and sacrifice, you're going to have a legitimation myth. And that legitimation myth is there and is in place to prevent you from seeing certain aspects of social reality. For example, that you don't deserve where you are, that you inherited it. So that has to be in place. And hey, it's your social identity to occupy that level to reap the benefits of inequality, because most of your friends will be in similar positions. So your social identity will be tied to that legitimation myth, and that will allow propaganda that feeds into your own legitimation myth, your own flawed ideology, to be effective.
It seems also that in order to even challenge your beliefs or that ideology that you're talking about, you would have to have information that would counter it. And, you know, people are not always looking around for that type of information that then they would have to question, well, why is it this way?
Right. So information bubbles. So what a flawed ideology does is it enables you, even when confronted with the information, to disregard it. So, for example, certain politicians have successfully portrayed universities as giving, as, you know, the sources of falsehood, and climate scientists as the purveyors of flawed ideology. So people discount the information that they're given from those sources. But if you don't even have access to the sources, if you only get information from venues that strengthen your own flawed ideologies or your own ideologies, you know, then matters are unfortunately quite hopeless.
There's been quite a bit of research among psychologists and political psychologists and such about a couple of phenomena here. One is that when you do get information that is counter to what you really believe, that there is a cognitive dissonance that makes it very uncomfortable to listen to. And I think that is one factor here. How do you suggest we deal with something like that?
Well, what to do is always the hardest. I take myself as a chronicler of what is, but we now have to shift into what to do. You have a cognitive dissonance because, you know, all theories of ideology must explain the facts to which you're drawing our attention. We don't like to hear information that's inconsistent with our legitimation myths, that's inconsistent with the beliefs that form our ideology. So they're very uncomfortable. We seek alternative explanations. So one thing that could be done is diversifying our friend groups so that people are reached. Unfortunately, this strategy is tricky because it's been used to argue that we should have more people involved who have really problematic ideologies. So, and it's true, it would be good to have a sense of what undergirds someone who, say, hates my people, Jewish people, you know, to understand where they're coming from. But I do think, you know, it's important to somehow, I don't think we can approach the question about what to do without being clear that some views are true and some are not true. And there are various ways to find out what's true, and the scientific method is one, and empirical research. I mean, what happens in the university? I mean, I'm very, you know, methods and practices of investigating the world are parts of our ideologies. And you and I believe in the methods and practices of the Enlightenment or something like that, but what happens in universities? And, you know, the problem we now face is that there are people who challenge those methods. They say, no, science is ideological. And so how do you address that? How do you address that without having some societal decision that these methods, for instance, scientific methods, are to be trusted? I'm not sure you can overcome that. We just have to recognize that there are facts out there. And when we give up on that, we're sunk. And then we need to discuss, you know, whether the methodology used by, say, climate science is a good way to find out what the facts are. And you look at the people who disparage climate science, and they have strong financial interests in so doing. And you can sort of point that out, maybe. But I don't know if there's any way. One has to have truth as a value, and there has to be intersubjective agreement on basic methods for discovering the truth. And what I'm concerned about now is that that ground has been undermined.
On a much lesser scale, even in the academy itself, there can be problems that we are ourselves blind to. And you point that out rightfully in your preface of your book.
Yes. I mean, the academy is what is what justified mass incarceration. So absolutely right. Yeah. Often what happens is the societal ideologies get through to the academy and then are, as it were, whitewashed, and then handed back to societies for society as a legitimation of their legitimation. So this is what happened with mass incarceration when John DiIulio, a professor at Princeton University, came up with super predator theory with Vincent Fox of Northeastern. And so then they, deeply affected the 1990s, the criminal justice debate. He said there's a generation of super predators growing up, and he predicted a fivefold increase in violent crime. And so between 1995 and 2000, violent crime dropped precipitously in the United States between 1995 and 2000. So you could say by the standards of the academy, those errors get found out. But you're absolutely right that statistics, we're not God. We have a limited amount of time to find things out, even via scientific research. So we have to discard. Certain hypotheses are going to seem more sensible to us. And because we have just a limit, we're only on Earth for 80 years if we're lucky, we have a limited time, we can't investigate every possibility. It's going to be our pre-existing ideologies that determine which hypotheses we find more likely. And so the university is going to be deeply affected by the external ideologies of society because we can't investigate every possibility. We only have time on this earth and within the confines of a junior faculty career to get tenure. You only have a few years. So you have to look at hypotheses that will maximize your chances of getting tenure, maximizes your chances of getting research support, which means if your government happens to be xenophobic, or as happened in the early 1990s with drug policy, as the Columbia neuroscientist Carl Hart has documented in his book, High Price, research money went to those who said that drugs are really, really, really bad. And what happened is that people produced experiments where they gave mice like an amount of cocaine that would kill a human. And they said, look, cocaine is bad for you. Or they had this experiment where they, the famous experiment where they put cocaine and, I'm not recommending the use of cocaine by any means. But nevertheless, there was a tremendous amount of drug propaganda that Carl Hart documents presented under the guise of science. Famous experiment, you put a mouse in a cage and you give them the choice of taking cocaine or eating food. And the mice decide each time to take the cocaine rather than the food, and they die. So this was used in policy. And then someone else did an experiment where they added a running wheel to the cage. And what they found is that the mice did not die and often ate the food because they would run on the running wheel and weren't as bored. So in the first experiment, the mice were literally bored to death. So absolutely right. The incentive structure changes radically. The incentive structure for the university is a function of the greater society. And that means that the clear distinction I wanted to draw can't be drawn.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful interview.
Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works.